Ladies and gentlemen, it is your favorite time of the week. It's time for Dearly Debated Deep Dives. We are here. We have your guest host, Liam Maxwell. Special guest appearance from Christian, Liam's friend. In the producer chair this evening, yours truly, Greg Friends. And your host for this fine evening, the man himself, Nathaniel William Levinson. I've actually gotten his middle name right every time.
Yeah, that's why he keeps using a different one, even though I corrected him on the first podcast.
I don't remember the other ones he's used. First of all, too many air horns for Greg.
Yeah, we can all agree he gave himself too many air horns.
What's a
correct amount of air horns?
Well, less than double digits.
For you, maybe none.
Half an air? Can you do half an air horn?
What is half an air horn? I can't even.
Just like...
It can only be multiple air horns for me. That's my problem.
Hit it and then hit another sound and it should cut it off.
It physically
try hitting that sound and then hit another sound really quickly and see if it cuts it off.
Bro. Are you recording?
This is how we prove to everyone that we're real life people
and
not
friends.
This isn't just like Dolly and ChatGPT making a podcast.
That's true, yeah. Yeah,
I should have intro'd somebody as ChatGPT.
ChatGPT.
Christian's last name is Liam's friend.
Yeah.
It's a long one. It's hyphenated though.
Liam's friend. Well, it's like Olafsson.
Sure.
Liam's friend.
Liam's friend.
Your last name just it indicates your relationship.
It's Nordic.
It's very common.
Yeah,
yeah.
It is. Yep.
Yeah. Liam's friend.
It's actually pronounced. Hello, I am Christian. Liam's son. Liam's friend.
Liam's son.
Liam's friend.
I like that. I'm going to start calling Christian my son.
My son. Right, so we watched Oppenheimer.
Boy, did
at
we.
Midnight
mm-hmm. at the special
at 10 p.m. in IMAX, I remember, and again, I've only been to IMAX at Discovery Place, but I remember being like a wraparound screen, like panoramic sort of thing. Is that like just Mr. Cinematographer? Can you explain what IMAX actually is?
Okay, so IMAX just means it's like it's not wide frame. If you remember Dunkirk, right? Two
nope.
movies ago from Nolan.
Didn't watch it.
If you watched his movie in IMAX, you would see plenty of wide shots, and then there were IMAX shots that actually it would fill the frame wide, like with its height. So the shot would keep scrunching and then growing and scrunching and growing, and you wouldn't really notice it too much unless you were like really paying attention to the tops and bottoms of the screen. But IMAX just means that it's that view for like the whole movie. It also just means it's a bigger, like the audio is going to be
more. The audio is incredible.
Yeah, the audio
and we
is
all
different.
Experienced but
that.
I did the Scott Pilgrim vs. the World 10th anniversary. I did in the like the Dolby 12.9 or whatever.
Well, I will say,
and
like,
my seat was vibrating. It was
it's like 4D.
What was funny about that is so there's a lot of fights, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And every time someone got punched, I was like, that person's head just broke because it was just it would make this huge sound, and your seat would shake with someone getting like slapped. And you'd be like, that person is dead. They're dead. There's no way you survive a slap like that. It was just like devastating. Every blow was just devastating.
Well, I will say that like there are a few museums, and it sounds like the one here has the same thing. Oh, a wraparound screen is a bit different.
Yeah.
And in my opinion. Nah, like it's too much. It's too much. You can't
what,
really
the wraparound
see
screen.
Yeah,
but I'd probably agree.
But I was young when maybe the screen seemed bigger. But I remember, it's doing like these flyover zoom shots, and it feels like you're moving.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then IMAX was just kind of like, I mean, it was great. Don't get me wrong, but I don't know if it was worth double the ticket price.
It was more so the audio that I.
Oh yeah, the audio was incredible.
Was different.
It was
than most,
which I guess for this movie in particular was. A really big plus.
It was huge.
Pretty
we'll get into the score.
The audio felt
it started at 10, but it went well past midnight. So I guess technically it was at least part of it was a midnight showing. So I guess
that's true. Yeah.
What is a midnight showing anymore? Honestly,
data showtime at 5 p.m. Do you guys know that? Right before.
Why couldn't we have gone to that one? I'm so tired that night.
Weren't one of you the ones that told me? That they changed him from being legit midnight showings because like people just kept getting beat up and robbed and stuff.
Yeah, so I think from my understanding, the catalyst was when the Dark Knight came out at midnight.
Yeah.
There was a shooting at a theater in Colorado.
Oh, yeah.
And so I don't think that was the only incident, but I think that was like the major one that made movie theaters say too many bad things happen at midnight. We're just going to push it back.
It was a little sketchy.
Like the rowdy
there.
People.
I wonder, did more things happen than the shooting? We don't have to get into this drab start to the podcast, but like.
Guys, we're talking about Oppenheimer's bombs, not guns.
Yes.
Get it right.
If I could piggyback real quick.
There were technically people with guns in that movie. I don't think anyone got shot, but.
No one got shot. Fired. No one got shot. That movie going experience was amazing. Just a packed theater for what is
that was
one of
cool.
the most anticipated movies of my lifetime. That was really cool.
I would say the last the movies I've seen in the last 2 or 3 years have just been almost empty every time.
Yeah.
And this one was packed,
fair.
Which was nice. It was nice to have an actual packed theater.
It was cool. Yeah, it was cool.
I was a little disappointed that IMAX didn't have reclining seats.
Yeah.
I thought this was America. Apparently,
the seats are not great.
I think it's definitely a little tight next to the guy.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
I feel like it also is amplified in that our day and age now, movies really aren't. They're not made to be watched in theaters, and a huge part of the marketing scheme behind this movie was you've got to go see it in a theater. Like you've got to experience it in this way. The reel that we made for this that we shot on film doesn't even fit on the little thing. It breaks the machine. We have to build a more sturdy one to hold this massive reel that weighs 600 pounds or whatever it was.
600 pounds of film.
Yeah, and so they were very much like, you need to go see this in theaters, which it hasn't, like you said, Nathaniel, not really been something that we've seen in the past several years since COVID.
I would say,
and since everything went to streaming.
I would say the last movie other than Oppenheimer that I watched that I was like, you need to see, well, Scott Pilgrim, but that was a long time ago. The 10th anniversary, I'm not counting that. But the last movie I saw, I was like, this is so much better in theaters, was Mad Max Fury Road.
Yeah.
Where just like the spectacle and the sound. And I was in the front row, like reclining, just watching. Like it was the only thing in my vision. And that was incredible. And that's, you know, Oppenheimer, I think, is a similar, you need it to just kind of envelop you.
Yeah.
Well,
we've got
a lot to talk about, and we got a guest here. So why don't you guys start us kicked off, Nathaniel, with give us a little synopsis of what the movie was.
Yeah, so like Oppenheimer is about Kenneth Branagh turning into it's about Ryan Gosling and Margot Robbie.
Oh my god!
Oh, no, sorry.
The other one.
Yeah. So Oppenheimer is about the life of Robin Oppenheimer, who is widely considered the father of the atomic bomb. He was the leader on the Manhattan Project, which developed the atomic bomb during World War II. And this is based off of a biography that I believe is called The Life and Tragedy of
American Prometheus,
The Life and Tragedy of
J. Robert Oppenheimer,
which apparently they mentioned this in the movie. Apparently the J is literally just the letter J. It doesn't actually stand for anything.
It's badass.
So the movie takes parts in thirds. It's a 3-hour long movie, and it's three sections that are roughly an hour apiece. There's the pre-Manhattan Project, and this is not spoilers, since this is all, well, first of all, it's historical fact, so you can look at Wikipedia and see what happened.
What happened to the bomb?
Did they succeed? Did World War II end? I don't know. There's the pre-Manhattan Project as the first hour, and that kind of culminates with him getting put in charge of the Manhattan Project. Then the second hour is the Manhattan Project, and that culminates with the Trinity Test, which I think was one of the greatest sequences that's ever been put to film. Then the last hour is the post stuff, which one of the reviews I was watching called it, you know, you have the build up to the bomb, and then the fallout, which made a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, what happened to him afterwards, because he ended up being disgraced and disavowed by the U.S. government largely because of his dealings with the Communist Party.
Yeah.
Which, you know, in the 60s, if you know anything about the Red Scare, McCarthyism, you don't want to be a communist. Now, you still don't want to be a communist today. Let me make this very clear. Don't be a communist because millions of people die, and that's being totally serious. Communism leads to mass murder and starvation and horrible things. So if you think like, oh, real communism's never been tried, why don't you go live in a communist country and see how it works, and then come back and let me know how much you like communism. So that's kind of what happened to him. And there is, if you want to know more about McCarthyism and how that kind of pervaded American society, and it was not, you know, despite me thinking communism is one of the most despicable worldviews imaginable, the whole Red Scare thing was a swing in the complete wrong direction, where people were encouraged to basically, you know, betray your neighbor and be like, I think they're a communist.
Right. And like if you had suspicion, had any kind of suspicion, it was
so,
like,
Yeah. So if you want to, if you want to see something that's a movie that's about that era, that's very good. I recommend Good Night and Good Luck. Liam will hate it because it's in black and white, even though it's a more modern
movie.
Horrible. It's it was so I saw it when
although
I was like,
I like the black and white Oppenheimer. Yeah. I want to make that
stuff. I saw it when I was like 12. And, you know, 12 year old Nathaniel was like, I want action and bombs. And this is like a talking movie, like just talking. And I thought it was incredible at 12. So I haven't watched it in a while, but I bet it still holds up. But that's the basic gist. It's his life in three acts.
Right.
The stuff before the bomb, and then after the bomb.
And it's not necessarily linear.
Yeah, it's not told linearly.
Yeah.
So there's Liam said, there's stuff because in black and white, and the stuff in black and white is the stuff that's taking place after the bomb. So it does cut roughly, you know, it cuts between Oppenheimer before he was on the Manhattan Project, Oppenheimer during and after, and roughly what the movie would consider present day is in black and white.
Mm-hmm. And you guys can correct me if you disagree, but I kind of viewed it as his hearing when he was a little older after the war was like the movie, and then like
it's a framing device is like a flashback.
The flashbacks was like the prior to Manhattan Project and Manhattan Project, and then like after that was the Strauss cabinet hearings.
Right. So that's how it's framed. It's framed as Robert Downey Jr.'s character Levi Strauss. I think Levi.
Is that the gene guy?
Strauss is his last.
Strauss is his last name, but he's up for a cabinet position, and so he's appearing before members of Congress. They're asking him questions, and one of them is about his relationship with Oppenheimer, and that's kind of used as a framing device to go through Oppenheimer's entire life. But again, it's not presented chronologically, so it doesn't just like start with that, and then it does all the flashbacks like in order. It just – I don't know if I say – to me, it felt kind of like Kill Bill, where – you had a movie that worked in a chronological order, and then he just kind of rearranged things for dramatic effect.
Sure, I think that's fair.
And we can talk about whether that
very,
worked or not. But
very Christopher Nolan.
Yeah, it was very Nolan-esque, very Memento. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. And I don't know if you – I did some research after this because there's a lot to unpack. But Nolan is on record as saying the black and white is Strauss's point of view.
Yeah,
and that definitely seems like that. The colored scenes would be Oppenheimer's point of view.
Yeah. And that definitely holds up because, you know, everything that happens in black and white is about Strauss.
Yeah.
Right.
And then obviously all the colored stuff is, I think Oppenheimer's in almost every single shot.
Yeah.
Like it the camera follows him very closely.
Yeah.
All right. So what are your thoughts? Tell me about Nathaniel. Why don't you start us off? What were your thoughts of the movie? Give us your kind of your general.
Well, I thought it was an excellent movie. You know, Christopher Nolan's talking about it like it's his magnum opus, like it's the best thing he's ever done. I don't know if I'd say it's the best film ever made. He's like, it's the most important film I've ever made. I don't know if that's true. You know, a lot of if this movie had come out in like the 70s, I could see that. But, you know, we are almost 100 years past the Manhattan Project. So, you know, a lot of the philosophical implications, we've kind of moved past that. So, you know, stuff that is on people's minds is more about AI now than nuclear Armageddon, even though that arguably is still a threat. I thought the movie was too long. But unlike a lot of the other three-hour movies we've been watching, this one didn't make me look at my watch like, oh, my God, when's the movie over?
Sure.
But it was definitely overlong. I thought all the sex scenes with Florence Pugh could have been cut out and you wouldn't have lost anything. The Trinity tests is such a tremendous – I think I think within this movie is some of the best film ever made.
Mm-hmm.
And the Trinity test, which comes like at the two-hour mark, was just an absolutely sensational piece of film work. And then you get that huge climax, and then the movie goes on for another hour. So I think especially because he was doing it not chronologically, he could have rearranged things. And I'm not like ending with the bomb explosion, although honestly I would have been okay with that happening and then just cuts to credits. I think that would have been incredible.
Yeah.
And so you just walk out of the theater like shaking.
Mm-hmm.
I think an hour after that, after you have this just huge moment, you have an entire hour cooling off period where stuff is still happening. You still have to be paying attention. And I'm like, I'm coming down off adrenaline high. I need to chug a Gatorade. And so having an hour of, you know, conversations and backstabbing and political machinations and things like that, that you have to really be putting a lot of brain power in to follow I think could have been done better. I didn't think it was bad, but I think it could have been done better, and the pacing could have been tightened up. Maybe if you made like, I think it could. I would, unlike some movies, I don't think you could cut this down to like 2 hours. I think maybe 2.5 hours, cut off like a half hour of the fallout portion and kind of accelerate that, and maybe like 15 minutes of the beginning. I think all the Manhattan Project stuff you keep, and then move the bomb Trinity test part close to the end. I think it would have been a better experience for me. I think still think it's a fantastic movie, definitely worth watching, especially in theaters. But yeah, I wouldn't say it was a perfect movie. Okay. And I saw something where someone was like, it has both the best of Nolan and the worst of Nolan. It's just anything you like about Nolan, it's amplified.
Very, very
everything you don't like about Nolan, it's also there.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the acting was brilliant. All the actors, especially Cillian Murphy, just absolutely sensational. Everything is a little clandestine, like very sanitary, very mechanical, which for the bomb portion, I think works really well. But for the pre and post bomb portions where it's supposed to be about Oppenheimer's relationships, really.
Yeah.
It's a bit sterile. And again, the acting is phenomenal from everyone. But it doesn't, I don't know, the emotional beats that are supposed to be there don't really resonate. They feel almost like they were written by an alien who's not quite gotten the grasp of how human emotion works, which might have been the idea for Oppie. But I didn't get that impression from Cillian Murphy. You know, you get the idea that he's this troubled man, but you don't really get to hear his thoughts, which I think would have kind of lent a little bit more emotional weight, because you see him looking tortured, but he never says anything to indicate that he's tortured.
Yeah,
he just looks tortured, which Cillian Murphy does a really good job of. Mm-hmm. But if he had had like maybe a moment where he breaks, like he's by himself and he just breaks down or something like that, I think would have lent a little bit more emotional weight to those scenes. But all in all, I enjoyed it quite a bit.
Is his name Cillian Murphy?
Might be
Cillian.
It's Cillian.
I believe it's Cillian.
I thought it was Cillian. Or something.
It's a hard C.
It's a hard C.
Are we coming from
Cillian? No, it's definitely Cillian. Okay. I think I heard him say his name before.
Huh.
Okay.
We'll check.
Looking it up now.
Hey Google, how do you pronounce Cillian Murphy?
You said it, Cillian Murphy. It's not, you can't use voice.
Speechmodification.com presents how to pronounce Cillian Murphy.
There you go.
It's literally on YouTube,
so therefore if you type it's correct. In
how do you pronounce on Google, the first one is how do you pronounce Cillian.
Really? It's a tricky one. It's a hard C.
In like the Gaelic languages, the CI is a hard C.
Yeah, yeah.
Even though in
last
English
time
it's not.
I studied Gaelic, it was a lot different than that.
Did you actually study Gaelic or is it a bit?
It's like you swimming.
All right, Liam, tell us your
So I'm going to take it a step further.
Yeah.
I'm going to say it's nearly a perfect movie. I'm going to have some hot takes in the opposite direction as what my hot takes typically are. It is one of my favorite movies I've ever seen in my life. It skyrocketed into my like top 10 probably ever. I love Christopher Nolan. This is like 1A, 1B with Inception. And I love Inception like more than almost any movie I've ever seen in my life again. But this movie is unbelievable. It's 3 hours. I didn't think it was that long at all. I would have seen it again the second it ended. I legitimately woke
up
the next morning.
They didn't have a 2 a.m. showing,
and wanted to watch it again. And unfortunately, I couldn't. Like, if I was around this weekend, I would have gone to see it again. Yeah. I was so enamored from the jump. The score had a lot to do with that. The score gripped me immediately. On top of everything else you've said, the actors' performances were phenomenal. The Trinity test was one of the best scenes ever.
I think a masterpiece of cinematography.
I also think the scene in the gymnasium after, when he's making the speech, is a masterpiece in cinema. Just the way it kind of like blurred out the crowd and muffled the cheers with children screaming. I mean, that was like the most horrifying. Like, that was more horrifying than like a horror movie.
I think that's where they should have ended the movie.
Here's my counter to that. It's a movie about Robert Oppenheimer.
Yeah.
So I'm totally okay with it going through his life.
Yeah.
It's a biopic.
Yeah.
If it was like a Manhattan, the movie was like Manhattan Project,
right,
then yeah, end after that, and that makes sense. But I heard that from you, I think, right after the movie, and I had to like digest it for a little bit. And I was like, man, I'm totally okay with it because I found a lot of drama in the courtroom scenes. It probably took me like a couple minutes from the Trinity test to like regroup and like be like, there's probably like 3 minutes of the courtroom scene where I was like, eh, whatever, whatever. But then it gripped me again in like a totally different, like nuanced way. And I just felt so like, yeah, I wanted to see it immediately afterwards. It is a nearly perfect movie. Top 5 to 7 all time that I've ever seen. And I think we're getting
Greg's opinion
there's
over
nothing,
here.
There's nothing. There is.
No. Okay. It's just because I know Liam. Final point. And okay.
There's almost, if not absolutely nothing, I here can critique.
Go. Okay.
So we're going to get to the part where we didn't like stuff. I got nothing. If the worst part of this movie.
So thank the thing God is, you can critique chair. Something while still saying, but I enjoyed it.
If the, of course. But yeah, I agree. Well, but see, I can't okay, critique well, anything. I mean, there's nothing I could have critiqued.
Well, here's the problem. You say it's in your top 5 to 7, but you've only seen 10 movies. So.
Oh. Listen, if
I'm making a Liam is Young joke.
If the worst part of this movie. If the worst part of this movie is Florence Pugh naked.
True.
That's going to be a win in my book. Okay, fellas. Sorry, Mom, if you're tuning in. But if that's the worst, but that's what we're critiquing, then damn, I'm all in. Okay.
Jeez, well, we know Louise, Liam, man.
Okay. I'm so curious to, if Greg is like going to like. Critique it. I don't even know what you would say, man. It'd be really, I'd be really fascinated to see what you have to say.
I only make fun because I know Liam, and I know when Liam sees something that he likes, it's not, hey, that was really good. It is, hey, that's the greatest day I've ever had in my life so far, Greg. I mean, the number of best movies that I have actually watched with Liam, he's got 12 favorite movies ever. There are 100 best scenes of all time. I mean, it's one of the most charming elements of Liam's personality, and I'm so glad that he's bringing, and he's unashamed. He believes it.
I believe it. Yes. This is not just for he's clicks not, yes, or anything. I'm being very genuine.
And that's why I love it so much. So,
but you're right. That's a fair point. Okay.
All right, Christian. Well, first off, Christian, why don't you tell the people a little bit about yourself? Who are you? Introduce yourself a little bit, and then tell us what you thought about
first
Oppenheimer.
First guest, Christian.
How does it feel to be the first guest on the legendary? Yeah,
welcome to the show, Deep Dive Podcast. Welcome to the show.
It's an honor. These guys got an incredible setup here. I'm very impressed, and you know, it's first time ever doing a podcast as well. So a lot of firsts in here. Mm. You know,
it's beautiful.
So
it's beautiful. This being streamed to millions of people.
If not billions.
Tens by this point.
I mean, is it out in space?
Billions, technically, you can multiply tens to get to billion.
Maybe aliens watching this.
Completely wrong.
So, Christian, you were one of the ones with us. Me, Nathaniel, Liam all got tickets, and then Liam told us he's bringing a friend, and you showed up. So tell us about your viewing experience, man. Like, did you like it as much as Liam? Did you like it like Nathaniel liked it? You think it was trash?
Yeah, so definitely one of the best... Probably the best dialogue movie that I've seen in a long time. There's some good dialogue shows out there that, you know, can hold your attention. I think the fast-pacedness of it was really well done. Usually in a dialogue movie that you hit some slow points and you kind of check out and then you get a little action or something, kind of brings you back in. But for 3 hours being locked in, I will say after the bomb, I kind of zoned out a little, you know. That was definitely a good climax, and I guess I was living off all the memes, living up to it, and like I just it's all about the bomb. It's all about the bomb, Oppenheimer, Barbie getting blown up, all of that. So I think a lot of my going into the movie was focused on how cool is this explosion going to be, and then. I checked my phone after the bomb went off, and I was like, this does not feel like it's been 3 hours, and I saw there's an hour left. So for an hour of the court, all those hearings and everything, that was not expecting that, but seeing Robert Downey Jr. really embrace the role, got to respect it, love that.
He killed it, man.
Yeah, he did.
So that was a game changer for me. I will say... I wish there was a little bit, you know, there was one big explosion, so that was cool. I thought it was going to show a little bit of World War II, you know, have a little bit of action in there just to kind of just kind of break it up a little bit. But then again, it's called Oppenheimer, not the Manhattan Project. We're not
exactly
doing a deep dive into the U.S. and World War II. It's about a singular person. So as far as that goes, I respect it. I think it's fair. And I can't imagine watching this at home on like Netflix, just turning it on. And being like, oh, three hours, Brooke, come on. Like, let's sit down. Let's watch this. Like,
I might if I were to watch it again, I would find like the best break points and then just watch it 1 hour at a time and like take a break in between.
but also watching it at home, period, just not having the audio.
It wouldn't be the same. The subwoofer at your house might do some good work. I mean, we're watching like Transformers and it's shaking the foundations of the house, so I think that
I think it'll be interesting to see how it does once it hits.
I think a good subwoofer will be your VHS. Friend if you're planning to watch
a
it
sub and maybe
when it hits
projector.
Betamax that's what's really gonna take off.
Projector screen, maybe if that can get widescreen enough for it, that would be
does your projector get widescreen, Greg?
My projector has
can we show IMAX quality
hot tub Oppenheimer? are we telling all of our fans just to meet us in the hot tub this winter to watch Oppenheimer?
We can fit all 10 billion of them in there.
That we would get very pruny in that hot tub, which is the length of this movie.
Well, the longest movie we tried to watch in the hot tub was Transformers 4, and it was so long we had to get out of the hot tub and finish it in the garage. It's so long. It was Oppenheimer's longer. So, but I mean, again, I will have my criticisms, but it didn't feel the pacing was excellent. So I never felt like, oh my God, this might be over. Yeah. I never felt that.
Here's the other thing I want to, because Christian brought up a great point that I didn't really touch on, was the dialogue. It was super dense. It was unbelievably dense. You couldn't really like
a lot of names.
You couldn't not pay attention for
a lot of names.
You couldn't not pay attention for like 30 seconds.
It's definitely not. It's definitely not a popcorn movie. It's a movie that you need to pay attention to, which is a good thing, right? It is not a mass appeal movie. It is a niche movie that rewards careful viewing.
Yeah. Everyone's like, Barbie outperformed Oppenheimer at the box office. Like,
Yeah, no kidding. Because you don't need to rate. In fact, it probably is better if you get a lobotomy before you go see Barbie. And then you won't notice that Barbie actively despises half of the population of the world.
I will say, going into the movie, Liam's like, he brought up the podcast. He's like, we'll be talking about this. He's like, ready to take some notes? And I'm like, dude, I listen to podcasts all the time. And like, I'll talk about it. And people are like, how do you remember that? And then I came out of the movie and I was just like, I don't even know the name of half the characters.
No,
like, they're complicated.
Okay. That has been a very widely critiqued part of the movie, is that even people that loved it are like, you and is Oppenheimer and the one other guy, I forgot his name. It's like, no, there were like 25 people and you don't know any of their names.
I think I didn't think I had a whole lot of trouble following it. I think there's a lot of characters.
Give me four characters.
Edward
names.
Teller. Klaus Fuchs was the Soviet spy.
Okay.
But Gene Talek was Florence Pugh.
Yeah, but I could also say Eisenberg and
Eisenberg. General Groves was Matt Damon. I didn't have there was like the tertiary characters, like Josh Peck's character and like the dude from Josh The Boys' Peck. Character.
Can we talk
who
about,
like, didn't have a role?
Can we
all.
Talk about Josh Peck being the one to drop the bomb, press the button? Like, if it was any of the
Wait,
other
wasn't
scientists,
he the one who was going to press the button to abort?
No,
he was the one who pressed the button.
He pressed the button to drop it.
Who? Wait, what was his character's name?
Josh Peck was. I think he was the abort button.
Let me take a step back. I don't know who Josh Peck is.
He's the guy from like Cody, Zach, and Cody.
Greg, put the camera on me. I need to speak to camera for a second.
Okay.
So, my brother would say my facial recognition software was not installed on the right day. I have trouble differentiating faces. I don't know who that is.
Do you remember him in the movie?
He didn't look like that.
He played. He played.
Was he the guy who was in the Manhattan Project? In the Manhattan Project first. Anyways,
it was just
the
point is, place.
I until like the end of the movie, I thought that Florence Pugh's character and Emily Blunt's character were the same person.
That's
joking.
Egregious.
Because it's like showing. Because I thought like, oh,
one was
he goes
naked,
to this communist party.
On.
He goes to this communist party. That. He has a fling with this girl, and then he gets married to her. But then he like went and had the tryst with her, and then I was like, wait, they're not the same person.
The movie definitely didn't do you any favors with how they like paced it, because it definitely like if that was just a mannequin walking around, you would assume it's the same person. However,
but I legitimately thought that they were the same character.
And one was very
clothed, and one was very clothed. But I was looking at their faces, and they looked the same to me.
Sure, you were if looking
they,
at their faces.
Well, maybe if they had both hair. Been naked, classic I could have had some other point of comparison. But I saw a naked person and a clothed person, and I thought they were the same person. I think it's reasonable. Goodness, I was like, oh, bro. If you put clothes on that, that's about what it looks like.
That's sexist, man.
I do it to guys, too, so it's equal opportunity not knowing what the heck I'm talking about.
Oh, all right, man. Christian, do you have any more thoughts? We kind of cut you off there and became ourselves. For So it was overall, you thought it was good, but not as good as Liam.
Yeah, I thought it was good. Not top 10. Okay. Can we talk about Drake and Josh? I mean, I'm just kind of I'm shocked.
These two don't even know who Drake and Josh.
I know who Drake and Josh
are.
It's a masterpiece.
Okay, so I grew up with like but, turning
so
the
that,
antenna
so Josh
outside.
Peck is Josh from Drake
television.
And Josh.
Yes. Exactly. Okay.
There, I saw a meme.
Was Drake in the movie or no?
No. Drake's dead. Maybe.
Wait, really?
I don't know.
He's
he might
a rock
be.
Star. Right?
No, that dude's
so he might be dead.
That dude's in trouble somewhere, man.
I was just waiting for Megan to be played.
Gregory.
Hello.
What'd you think?
What'd you think? You guys ready?
I'm ready for Greg to have a hot take.
I'm
going to get angry.
I do not have a hot take. Unless a hot take is disagreeing with Liam. Then I have a very hot
not,
take.
That's a regular take.
That's a regular take, yeah.
Okay, so obviously this movie had a ton of hype. Me and Liam were talking about it just before the movie that I was like, man, I'm so excited for this. I hope I don't overhype it. And Liam was like, it's kind of like, I feel like it'd be hard to overhype it. Once again, counting as chickens before they hatch. But, okay, overview, amazing. Should probably win best movie of the year. Acting, phenomenal. Acting was phenomenal. I would agree that the Manhattan Project portion of the movie was super intense. I mean, I don't think that I could have predicted that I would react that way to bomb sequences.
Oh, can I tell them what happened?
Yeah, you can tell.
So we're sitting in a theater, and the bomb scene is happening, and there's a pause before the actual shockwave hits, and yep. So it's very quiet. And I see Greg just go and cover his ears before the bomb explosion hits.
I was unashamedly like waiting because we look at this theater was like booming like
yeah,
the sound
was, the
would like
was
shake
very
you
loud.
In the and there's already been a few small bomb tests where you see the bomb go off, it waits a couple seconds, and then you hear the sound, which was a really cool effect because it did that exact thing to you. It mm-hmm. made you sit there going, all right, well, when it's almost like seeing lightning and then knowing it's gonna, you know, this the crash of thunder is gonna happen. So it's obviously this build up to this amazing scene of them testing the nuke, and they test it. And you see it, and they're all just enamored by it. It's amazing. It's beautiful. And you're starting to get enamored, but I'm like, wait, no. They're going to suck you in, and then they're going to hit you with it. And I'm kind of waiting, and that's when I plugged my ears in. But that portion of the movie was stunning. I think most of the ways – so this is obviously a biopic, so it's not going to be Nolan telling his – like using his creativity like he does in The Prestige or Inception, where he's creating a story from the ground up, which I'm always going to prefer those movies. Like biopics – usually aren't my favorite thing because I mean I think you can make a really great biopic and I still probably wouldn't put it in my top frame of movies, but I can still appreciate it for being an amazing movie. I think he did a really good job of this. So my critiques are honestly against like on the backdrop of like other Nolan movies, not in the critiques of like, hey, we've been watching, you know, Disney animated remakes and against those. Yeah, it's OK, I guess. No, it blows crap movies like Barbie and the Disney remakes out of the water. But as far as it pertains to like a Nolan movie, yeah, I think he was trying to pace the movie like a bomb. Like that's kind of my takeaway was that the beginning of the movie is the antsy buildup. Even him like having his dreams and the kind of really sadistic part where he tries to kill his professor at the beginning, and then he continues to kind of be a womanizer, and it's very jumpy and all over the place. And then it kind of there's like this little bit of calm before the storm where you get the Manhattan Project portion of the movie where it all starts to slow down. And I said to Liam, I'm like, it's like when Matt Damon's in the movie. All of a sudden, I can understand it.
He was the everyman.
Because, like, he talked slowly and, mm-hmm. like, simplified things. And then, of course, you had the bomb going off. And then the last hour would be, like, the fallout from the bomb. Yeah. Like, the last hour represented the fallout of his life, you know? Like, mm-hmm. So he builds up like a bomb. He goes off like a bomb. And then there's a fallout on his life as a result of the things he's done. So I think his pacing, that would be my wild guess, considering that he's just kind of, like, an all-over-the-place creative kind of a guy. He also just likes to tell movies in weird time frames. Like, it's a super... As soon as it started, I was like, oh, great, here we go again. Which is just not my favorite way to tell a movie, when you're like, hey, like, who knows what time? Like, we don't know. Like, this could be the past.
Well, it gives you visual cues, though.
And by the end of the movie, you definitely get it, right? By the end of the movie, you're 100% like, ah, I know what's going on. The black and white is here. These portions are flashbacks, and these portions are kind of being represented as like the main point of the movie, which is the Manhattan Project in the middle, where he's actually making the bomb. And so you caught on. I would just say, like, what? I don't know what advantage that gives you, though. Like, that's always my question, is like, why not just tell it chronologically or in a smoother way? Why not just I don't know why you need to jump all over the place with time to make it, I don't know, more nuanced. But it's never been my favorite thing in Dunkirk. That's what I thought was the falling out of Dunkirk, was the strange three timelines. Other than that, that was a great movie. I thought this was a great movie too. I thought that the time thing was unnecessary. Yeah, the sex scenes were unnecessary too. There are some just like, it's not even that they're just sex scenes. Like, they're not acting very human. And Nathaniel pointed this out, where even the prior to the bomb portion of the movie, you're just kind of like, I'm like, they don't act like real people. Like, it's like their interaction isn't like you'd imagine people react. And so you're all, like, that, those were the points that I was drawn out of the movie. And I'm like, it's very, very obviously an actress sitting in a chair naked and a guy sitting in a chair naked, and they're being told to have a conversation. Other than that, I'm like, why is this happening? It added nothing to the movie.
Yeah. And it's one thing for him to portray Oppenheimer, who's this, you know, disturbed, driven genius, to be kind of emotionally stunted.
Yeah.
And it's another thing for everyone else to also be that emotionally stunted.
Well, that's the thing. It was like every interaction he had, especially on until you got to Robert Downey showing some emotion with his like colleague, I guess, mm-hmm. whoever. Mm-hmm. And a few of, like, during the Manhattan Project, there was a lot of raging emotions, which is great. Emily Blunt played her character mm-hmm. magnificently, and she definitely portrayed a lot of manic emotion, yeah.
And
I guess.
And that was so interesting to me, because it almost felt like she was in a different movie.
Yes, yeah. She really felt like one of the only people acting like a human for some of it.
It's like, and her and Matt Damon had human emotions and nobody else did.
Edward Teller.
He was good.
Yeah. But I mean, is there any credibility to the fact that they're all like just next level, like generational geniuses who just like aren't, like, right, are kind of robotic?
I can see Oppenheimer, but Florence Pugh's character was just some communist person.
Yeah, yeah. I guess
communists
are
robots.
That. But like,
so
most of the movie was scientists, like was like unbelievably sure. nerdy and talented scientists.
Sure,
like, I didn't get drawn out by like them being weirdly
right. But that's the Manhattan Project portion, and that part being more sterile and clinical makes sense mm-hmm. versus the before times, where it's Oppenheimer interacting with what are supposed to be just normal everyday. Even like his brother,
yeah,
was just weird because his brother's just supposed to be some dude who's a communist.
Some dude.
And it's just like, beep, boop.
His brother was pretty irrelevant.
Yeah. They kept coming back to him, which I was like,
yeah.
I don't even know what I can't even picture his face in my head. Again, that might be a me issue.
Yeah.
Like, I don't even know what he looks like.
I guess
it
was just important just to like maintain the through line of his ties with the Communist Party.
Yeah.
Just true. Like his yeah. brother also was a communist.
It was very obvious, though, when you watch the movie that it is not, in fact, a movie about the Manhattan Project, like Christian mentioned.
Yeah.
This is a movie about Oppenheimer. I mean, it's about who he was growing up. Or growing up, being from college forward, who he was once he got recruited to be in the Manhattan Project, through the Manhattan Project, and then the murkiness of his life after that, and all like the strange things that happen as a result of creating a nuclear bomb,
mm-hmm. right.
which is understandable. I think that the problem with making him so callous is that before the Manhattan Project, you're like, I struggled to like relate to him. Mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, I'm supposed to be drawn in and feeling these emotions in some way. Like, this is what a movie tries to do. And afterwards, I certainly felt them because I was, the bomb like affected me. Cause I'm like, wow, feeling that power. Mm-hmm. Imagine this guy who just created it, what he must be thinking. And one of the most disappointing part of the movies. Okay. So I don't know if you guys have seen this, but there is actually a clip of Robert Oppenheimer saying that really famous
"I become death, destroyer
yeah,
of
yeah.
worlds."
He's sitting there, and I don't know what this is from, but it's a close up on his face, and he's looking at the ground, and he's pondering, and he's like, "It makes me think of the line in the you know, the Hindu whatever, where Vishnu is talking to so and so, and he says, now I have become death, the destroyer of worlds." And he takes a big breath, and he just kind of looks at the ground, and it's just like It's super powerful. Mm-hmm. They chose to deliver that piece
during the sex
during her.
They said it again. They said it twice.
But
in the movie.
No, but when it
the
so,
second time, the second time was
the second
powerful.
Time, but the second time it wasn't even someone saying it. It was him. It was him remembering.
Yes.
That
I
line.
Thought that was powerful.
I mean,
man.
It was, but the but way they delivered the first time was
like what is it like? What's his goal there to say, hey, this is the one thing that I've actually seen come out of the mouth of Robert Oppenheimer. Like the one thing I know is that, hey, he's the guy that said that line. That's for me interpreting a lot of how he might feel, how he's feeling is he doesn't really know. He's like, well, some people cried, some people laughed, some people didn't know what to do. I feel like I've become death. And that's all I know about Robert Oppenheimer. And it's very mysterious and cool. And in reality, you're telling me there was some girl who wasn't his eventual wife. It's just some random bimbo that he's banging. And she grabs the Hindu Vishnu, whatever, off Beta. The wall, brings it over, holds it against her boobs, which is like, yeah, like it's literally her breasts. And underneath it is a book full of letters you can't read. So what am I supposed to look at? And then he's like, oh, it says, I have become death. And then it just cuts to a different scene. Yeah, and I'm sure like, that's where you're going to use it? Really? You're going to use it there? Like, that seemed like a swing and a miss to me.
And the way he was cutting it, it really felt like they could have recreated that interview.
Yes.
And shown like bits of it through the movie and then held off on that last bit and then put that right in before the bomb detonates. Like, they put the line in right before the bomb detonates and then just put that part in.
I thought.
And then cut to the explosion.
If you would have told me that they wouldn't put that part in that interview in the movie anywhere, I'd have been like, 0% chance that's true.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the only thing I know about this guy other than he made the bomb is that this is how he feels, the short 40-second clip, and it's super powerful. Like that in itself is a more interesting video clip than a lot of movies I've watched over the last month. Like there's so much to draw from it and they're like, no.
Really feels
even
like a missed
that
opportunity.
That is, everybody knows that's how it happens because there's a real video of it out there. we're not going to use that. So, again, I know I'm pointing out things I didn't like, but the movie was amazing. Yeah. I agree with Nathaniel in the sense that I think it could have ended in the second act. I think if you're going to be creative and mess with timelines and make it end with the Manhattan Project. Like talk about the aftermath as the second act. Start off with him growing up, but then be flashing from him growing up to him to the aftermath of him making the bomb. People will get that. Like those are the two timelines you're following. And then him growing up eventually leads into Manhattan Project, and you continue to do flashbacks between aftermath, Manhattan Project, and then it ends right when he lights the bomb off. Because imagine the bomb going off, you feeling the jitters you felt after the bomb, and then roll credits. You had to walk out of the theater like that.
Yeah.
I would have liked it.
You wouldn't have liked it?
No.
I feel like I would have been shaking.
I don't think I would have either.
You would have loved it. Liam, you would have said that it was your favorite movie of the year.
It would have gone from 5 to 7 to...
There's no way that you're like, no.
I don't think so. Not as much as I liked what he did do.
So I think it should have ended after the stamping scene, like shortly after that.
After the what scene?
Where they're all stomping and he delivers a speech and then he hallucinates all the corpses. That was so powerful. Mm-hmm. I think that's the downer. If you want to end on a downer moment, yeah. I think that's it.
Yeah, I like that.
I'd be more inclined to agree with that.
Like even if they spaced it out so that it was like bomb, then trial stuff, and then it ends with that.
Mm-hmm.
Like it shows because the last scene is Oppenheimer and his wife just like walking back to their house. If they had done Robin Oppenheimer and then like pauses and looks back and remembers that scene and then it ends, I think that's a much more powerful ending. So again, I liked everything that was in the movie. I just feel like it kind of ended on a whimper, ironically, like a very not even like the lowest moment. It didn't end on the highest moment, and it didn't end on the lowest moment. It kind of ended at a neutral moment.
Well, also, I just felt like, did you guys feel like what was happening in the courtroom was carrying as much weight as it made it seem like it was? Because in reality, so this is my understanding. Maybe I'm wrong. In reality, Robert Downey Jr.'s character, whatever his name is.
Strauss.
He kind of set up Oppenheimer. Like he kind of screwed him with all like the people he put in place to interview him and all that stuff. They explain all this to basically his whole plan is because he was embarrassed. So this is his premise. Because he was an embarrassed person. And I know this is real. You can't change this. But this is what you're choosing to make the ending focus. Because this scientist guy was embarrassed, he decided to do a really deep investigation onto Oppenheimer and prove that he could have colluded with the communists and helped them create their H-bomb so that he would be taken off the current nuclear team, mm-hmm. like his clearance would be revoked.
Right.
Which happens. That doesn't get removed. That happens.
Right.
And the whole buildup is that now Robert Downey Jr. assumes that he's going to take a cabinet seat, and his plan gets revealed to the cabinet that he did all this messed up stuff, and so now he doesn't get his cabinet seat. That's so insignificant to me. In relative terms compared to nukes being dropped, who cares about this random guy? Like, and again, I know it's it's focusing on his life, but if you're going to tell me, like, the key moments of his life, I think that they made that seem super, super intense, and I'm like, wait, so this guy didn't get a job he wanted. Oppenheimer's still screwed. At the end, they do recognize that they're like, oh, like, he gets a medal of some kind, and, you know, for whatever that means, but I don't know. That seemed to me to carry so much less weight than the rest of the movie.
I mean, it's less weight compared to dropping to killing 200,000
people.
Well,
that's important. I think.
Why does it have to be the end, though?
So the thing is, I think that was actually the whole point of Strauss, is that he was insignificant, because he tells the story about something Oppenheimer said to Einstein, made Einstein hate him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then at the very end, it shows that no, Einstein was basically telling Oppenheimer, you're going to have to live with what you did. People will celebrate you. People will hate you. But ultimately, like, you can't erase this thing that you did.
Yeah.
That's something you're going to have to live with. And then it cuts to him getting the medal and receiving the accolades that he rightly deserved for it, but also, you know, carrying the weight of, but in some ways this was a horrific thing that you did.
And I think an important
And that's why I think if they had ended on the foot stamping scene,
yeah,
mm-hmm. would have really cemented that. Perfect. Rather than just him and his wife walking to their house.
I think an important note to what you just said about Strauss being unimportant was his aide? Strauss's aide?
Yeah, I didn't understand who his aide was, because his aide was like, don't worry, we'll get you through this. And then he finds out, he's like, what, you're a horrible person. Like, so who the hell
Strauss's
are you?
Strauss's nephew.
But I think he had a big, big part in that movie when he said, like, Strauss was going on and on about Einstein and stuff, and he's like, well, maybe it was about something more important than you.
Right.
And then the last scene was the actual dialogue between Einstein and Oppenheimer, where Oppenheimer's like, remember that one time I told you we might destroy
the
Earth?
The entire world, yeah.
Well, I think, or set off a chain reaction to destroy the Earth?
Right.
Like, I think we did.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I thought that ending was amazing. That being the last scene carried a ton of weight for me.
I do think it was really cool to set it up like that, to where you saw the interaction happen, but you didn't know what they said.
Yeah.
And to also have a main character of the movie interpret it incorrectly, and then you finally get to be a part of that conversation, which was really neat. I wasn't necessarily
compelled. I thought the aide saying that was like a little on the nose.
Yeah. I just wasn't as, again, it's just about pacing of a movie that the reason you keep your most intense part at the end is because you'll typically lose focus if it happens an hour before the movie ends. And so my point is that those are interesting things. That's cool. But none of it's even close to, like, the significance of the middle of the movie. And even is like, in comparison to his life, that was the most significant thing to happen. Because the movie doesn't – I guess it probably leans more so on the this was a bad thing side.
Well,
like, what did you guys think about that? Because that was something that I didn't know when I walked away.
I don't think it necessarily –
picking a side?
I don't think it necessarily made a point about – whether the bomb was a good thing or a bad thing. You get people's perspectives, and you get the idea that, you know, he understands that he was responsible for hundreds of thousands of lives.
Right.
They even mentioned the death count. And that's a burden on him.
Sure.
They don't mention it, but they're all, you know, and there is kind of like a, you know, maybe Japan was about to pull out anyways. That's debatable. I don't think they actively picked a side on that.
It seemed like, for the most part, they did a pretty good job.
Pretty even-handed.
Keep their hands out of that muddy water.
Because even Nolan said
it's
less about that, and it's more about the McCarthyism part.
Yeah.
And how that kind of ruined people's lives, which I don't think it's pro-communist, but it you know, again, the McCarthyism thing was not a good response to that.
Right.
And how, you know, despite this work that arguably ended a world war, because of these attitudes at the time, and because of someone's being incredibly petty, his life gets torn apart.
Yeah.
So he gets that high peak, which I understand why they put that moment, the foot stamping moment, because that's like his moment of triumph, and that leads right into his complete decline, which, you know, who knows how much time passed between those two moments. It might have been years. I don't know. I'd have to go back and, like, actually read the biography, 50s. Like, read the source material. But
hit taken away in the 50s. So it was it was a couple of years, but not, I mean, he lived till 60s. So these last 10 years of his life.
And eventually the U.S. government reversed their position and gave him a Medal of Honor or whatever it was. Whatever you think about the atomic bomb and whether we should have dropped it or not, the advances that were made through the Manhattan Project brought us into the nuclear age in terms of power and in terms of knowledge of chemistry knowledge of, you know, how the world functions. So there were good things that came out of it.
Yeah. All right, Nathaniel, like a lot of good things.
Science question for you.
We got a science question for Nathaniel. They kept talking about the nuclear bomb that they're making,
yes.
or the A-bomb.
Yes.
And then one of the guys, he was like the dude that got emotional at one point, was like, I'm storming off, I'm out of here. He kept talking
about... Was that Josh Peck?
That was Edward... No. Is that the Edward Teller, the hydrogen bomb guy?
Yeah, it was Teller.
So he's the one that suggested doing a hydrogen version of the bomb.
Right.
I don't know what that means. I know... I've heard the term hydrogen bomb, and I know in the movie they made a delineation between the two, that we made one, and then later we created, they called it a super, which was the hydrogen bomb. That I guess we figured that one out.
Yes.
Explain that to me in a little bit.
Okay, so most nuclear bombs that are not active, but like available today, are hydrogen bombs.
Okay.
And the difference is between nuclear fission and nuclear fusion. And so the whole first part of the movie is them basically debating whether it's actually possible to split the atom.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're like, oh, the Germans did it. They split an atom. And so a uranium atom is really, really big. It's the largest naturally occurring element. It's got 92 protons and, so it's 92 protons, and the naturally occurring form is U-238, or they need U-235. So that whole thing where they're like dropping the pebbles into the saying.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
Okay. So basically uranium-238, which is the most common form, you can't use it as nuclear material. It's stable. It's too stable.
Mm-hmm.
Uranium-235, which has three fewer neutrons, that you can use. And so what you have to do is you have to enrich it. And that was actually like a big problem, is how do you enrich uranium? It's because you have something – it's like a fraction of a percent is the usable stuff. And so what you do is you turn it into a gas. You make uranium hexafluoride gas, and you superheat it and spin it in a centrifuge. And there is actually enough of a weight difference that the U-238 moves to the outside. And you can purify the U-235, get higher content of that, because that's what you actually need. So that's what they were doing, is when they were dropping those things in. And then plutonium is a byproduct of doing nuclear reactions. It's not a naturally occurring element. But both of those can be used because they're both isotopes that are unstable enough that you can split them open. So basically the way nuclear fission works is you fire a really, really high-speed neutron at a uranium nucleus. It hits the uranium nucleus, which breaks into, I think, lead and bismuth. It splits into two halves functionally, and it releases a ton of energy and other neutrons, and it releases more than one neutron. So those neutrons can go and hit other uranium atoms. So that's what they call a chain reaction.
Mm-hmm.
It spreads. And so the worry was, like the theory, the almost zero chance, right, is that you start this chain reaction and it never stops. And so it basically just keeps splitting atoms infinitely and blows up the whole world. Holy Obviously, cow. That didn't happen. But that was like the fear. And that was where Act One ended, of them saying, hey, if we set this bomb off, we might destroy the entire world. Whoops.
Knowing that, could you build us one?
Yeah, that
sounded really simple.
So the thing is, first of all, you need a lot of – you can actually buy uranium-238 on Amazon.
Huh.
But uranium-235 is not easy to get a hold of. Like the actual enrichment process is requires very specialized equipment. A hydrogen bomb, on the other hand, doesn't go off of nuclear fission. It goes off of nuclear fusion. It's basically what happens in a star, is you have hydrogen, and there's so much pressure and heat that the hydrogen atoms fuse together to form helium, which releases a ton of energy. And more energy than nuclear fission. So the reason that Oppenheimer was like, well, then we're not even going to worry about it, was because he was like, wait, I think I can do this and it'll give us more energy. But in order to start the fusion reaction, because it requires a tremendous amount of energy to start a fusion reaction, I'll need to basically build a small nuclear bomb, a fission reaction to start the fusion reaction. So he's like, well, if you're working on the fission part, we haven't even solved that part. So let's just work on that. So that's what he was talking about. So that's what a hydrogen bomb is. It's more powerful than a fission bomb. The reason these bombs are like, you know, the size of a smart car is because, again, it takes a tremendous amount of energy to start the reaction. Once it starts, you get that chain reaction. But to start the reaction requires a tremendous amount of energy. So they use conventional explosives to do that. So the bombs are huge because they have like hundreds and hundreds of pounds of TNT. TNT in it. Yeah. I don't know if they actually use TNT, but
well, at some one point they describe weapon. It. They give a number. They're like, oh, it's the equivalent of however many.
Yeah. Tons so of they, TNT. They explain that like these explosions are going to be so big that the only way we can measure them is in the equivalent amount of TNT you would need to blow it up. And they're like, well, it's so big, it's going to be kilotons of TNT. Jeez. So that's how they measure the force of these bombs. It's like as though you had exploded, you know, whatever, 12,000 kilotons of TNT, which is a stupid amount of TNT, but right. That's the idea. It's like, oh, well, TNT produces this much force, and they're just multiplying that out.
And I guess the whole drama, which, I mean, I don't know, it kind of makes sense, right? If we're a country in a race to create bombs, and all of a sudden these other countries start sprouting up using the same techniques that we're using, that you would get very suspicious and you'd start like poking around at people.
Well, that was the whole point was like that was they're like, we know the Germans are working on this. We have to beat them to it, because if they whoever comes up with it first will win the war. So, now, the Germans ended up losing World War II because of them splitting up and losing on the Russian front before they had completed their work on the atomic bomb, because they had Heisenberg. So they had
one of the best.
Yeah, one of the best. One of the best nuclear physicists. Although they wouldn't have called them that at that point. And so it was a race. But then, you know, Germans surrender and they're most of the way through the Manhattan Project and they're like, okay, well, we're still at war with Japan. And by all accounts, it doesn't seem like they're willing to surrender unless we were to, they said, like, unless we were to, like, invade the mainland and conquer, like, take Tokyo,
right.
They're never going to surrender. And so the theory behind the bomb is we basically show them, like, if you don't surrender, we can wipe you off the map without invading you.
Yeah.
What was the good line? It was a really good line. It was like the first one was for so-and-so. The second one was to show them we'll just keep doing this until.
The first one was to show we can. And the second one was to show we won't stop until you surrender. Yeah. And here's one thing. I don't know about the historicity of this.
Right.
But Truman seemed like an asshole. I don't know if he was that flippant. That's I don't think he was that flippant about dropping nukes.
I mean,
right? I think for everyone involved, it was a very serious decision and one they did not take lightly. And Truman was just kind of like, "Hell yeah, nuke the Japanese!" Like, I don't think he was that gung ho about it.
Was it an anti-Truman movie?
I don't. That's why I was like, is there something about Truman I'm not getting? He was like that. I don't know. I'm not a history buff.
Yeah, I don't know enough about presidents.
At the very end, I got that because as Oppenheimer's walking out, he's like, "Get this sissy out of here."
Yeah, get this crab. Don't let that crab back in here. I'm like,
I thought that his line was kind of powerful, and
he's like, they don't care who built the bomb; they care who dropped it.
I thought he was trying to
encourage Oppenheimer to be like, yeah. That's why that line about the crybaby was so weird, because it sounded like he was saying,
yeah.
The blood's on my hands, not your hands. That's, which sounds more like
he might have even said that verbatim, that the blood's. But he basically said, he's like, "Do you think they care about the person that made it?" He's like, "They care about the person that dropped it, and that was me." And I was like, "Oh, that's so like what a word of encouragement." Yeah. That he's like, "Hey, I'm the president of the United States because I have to be ready to make decisions like this." That's part of the struggle of being, commander. I was about to say master and commander.
Master and commander.
Commander
in chief.
Commander in chief. There we go. Is you have to be ready to do things like that. And it would make sense that a really good scientist would struggle with that, but somebody who's been trained to become the president of the United States would have more integrity to say, hey, this is the right decision. I have to live with calls like this. And I thought that was him telling Oppenheimer, hey, I know you made it, but like I'm the one that used it, so don't worry about that. I thought that was a really cool thing.
Yeah, I thought
so
too. He's like, don't let that crybaby back in here. I was like, wait, what?
And you can't blame him for being like, dude, I know that you want to go, that you're having some mental struggles, but like, man, we really need you. Like, this is literally life and death. It's about protecting the country. Like, can you sacrifice for us? So I didn't, and I think they framed it more like, oh, look at this guy who clearly doesn't understand. He's just like this. He's just this. Yeah, like
yeah,
like,
but then that crybaby line what yeah, made the, it seem made, much more mean spirited.
Made it seem like
Truman was like, "I'm the one with the power. I have the bomb. It's me."
Because like that kind of changed a lot of my perspective on things. That so many different people that had a role in the dropping of the bomb probably have similar feelings and thoughts. Whereas like one, you have the president who made the call. I mean, you have all the people who were involved in the discussion. Probably feeling responsible. I mean, you have the pilot who flew the plane, or I mean, that guy is probably have a really interesting perspective. And then you have Oppenheimer who created the bomb. And it's like, I don't know if one carries more than the other. If you really think about it, I thought his line evoked a lot of really deep thought in me, which was really cool. But it did also make me feel like there were it was like frustrating at times because clearly Oppenheimer had no opinion on like anything. Like that was a very big point that they were making, is that he can't even tell you how he feels about things. He can't even tell you. And you're like, all right, dude, just get a freaking like get a grip. Like be super sad about it. Or don't. Like, but pick a direction because I need something to grab onto. And
again, I think you got a hint of that in the stamping scene.
Right.
The gymnasium scene, I guess. You got a hint of that, and I really wish they had leaned more into that because that was really powerful. And then they just kind of go back to beep boop. Me, J. Robert Oppenheimer, and his wife's like yelling at him, oh, fight back, fight back. And I wish he had responded and given some justification as to why he was or wasn't going to fight back.
Yeah.
He was more devastated about his communist girlfriend dying.
Right. Yes. That is the most emotion he showed.
Ran away, hurtled up on a rock.
That part was utterly confusing to me for several reasons. One, the suicide scene was really strange. She literally just got on her knees and dunked her head into a tub.
I think she took a bunch of pills. I think that's the implication. Is that she took
but
a bunch
then
of pills
she got on her knees and dunked her head into a tub.
Yeah,
and like it just doesn't,
and again,
that
maybe
doesn't
this
look
is,
like a classic suicide.
And again, see, I feel like I need to go and read the book because it feels like a lot of the stuff that we're complaining about may just be what happened.
That is, it is what happened.
Like,
that
she
is how
committed
suicide
like that.
I think it was like up. They left it up in the air too that like she could have been murdered because they were trying.
There's another person in that scene.
Yeah. Was there?
Yes. It was a glimpse, I swear. I noticed the same thing, and I was so confused.
They talked, the government was following him at the time and, like, caught his affair. So I think they kind of, and it happened soon after. He was like, hey, like, we're not talking to each other anymore. Like, this has got to end. She dies soon later.
So you think that you think she was knocked off by the Phibbies?
I mean,
I think the movie might have implied you're right.
I think it left it up for interpretation that she could have committed suicide, and you understand why.
I didn't
but
pick
also,
up on that.
You guys, did you notice the other guy?
No, I did not.
There was another. There's another human being in the bathroom.
But let me be perfectly honest. You talked about the soundtrack. I don't remember any music. From
I don't
that
either
at all.
I was gonna
like
say
the score.
I don't remember a single moment of music.
I remember
like the swelling like that. Kind of like the Dark Knight.
So it definitely,
but I remember that and the sound fading out. But
dude,
I don't remember any music
in
that movie.
I remember it
so
intently.
This is his second movie in a row going away from Hans Zimmer.
Ludwig van Goren.
Beethoven.
Hans Zimmer's the
guy does good work.
Yeah, I don't know when you have Hans Zimmer going. Yeah, I'll score your movies, and you're like, nah, I got another guy. Bruh,
bad decision,
bro. Are you guys saying you didn't like the score? Or
I'm saying I don't remember it. I don't remember any of it.
It's not that the score.
I have no opinion on it because I don't remember a single bit of music.
Okay,
in that
so
movie.
It was a lot of like intense violin. I did a little research on it. Like it was a lot of that to build angst for the bomb and for other scenes in the movie where it was building up. Like when he like it was kind of playing the equivalent of a bomb when it was just like in a courtroom or just him being interrogated, it was. But I'm with you in the sense that I can't hum any of the themes. I can't. I mean coming on
just
the tales of his other movies
it.
Where you watch Inception and you watch Interstellar.
That's all I remember. From Inception.
No, Inception has an amazing like through line.
But
theme.
can you hum anything other than like Time from Inception? Just off the top of your head.
Yes. Again. Yes.
Okay.
Oh, that's lying. My bad. Also Hans Zimmer.
The entire score from Interstellar and several of the
still haven't seen it. Uh-huh.
Of the pieces from Inception are super powerful. I would say that it definitely didn't jump off the screen to me. There's a lot of people. So this is, there's a lot of when people talk about musical scores, there's a group of people that say it, you shouldn't be able to tell anything because it shouldn't even, like, you shouldn't, it should just enhance the movie itself, which I think this one might have done a good job doing that. I'm more of the opinion that, like, I like thematical music. I'm more of a John Williams fan. Like, he's my favorite composer. He's the one who did Indiana Jones and Star Wars and all these themes that you're like,
yeah, so those
I
themes, like, they jump out at you when yes. they're playing. And yes. to me, that enhances, if it's well done, like a good musical theme, right. that really jumps out at
a
you.
A lot of them are also played multiple times again, throughout those movies.
Yeah,
sure.
Right. Yeah. And I think that, I actually think that's like a really good technique that's just not used as much today is when, it's used in superhero movies a lot, but when characters have themes, and so those themes, right. like when they show up,
right.
it plays
right.
those themes. Right. What movie were you watching that?
X-Men.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
X-Men does that. And sometimes, but I have zero opinion on the Oppenheimer music because I cannot remember even a single note.
Hmm. There were also,
which
a lot
I guess
of...
speaks to the dialogue that I was so entranced by the dialogue and the visuals, I just shut out all the sound other than the explosions.
I was gonna say there was also a lot of times in which they cut out all music at all. And
yeah.
it was just the sound effects because they're so powerful.
And
which
there was
I don't
really,
mind that at all.
Really
I don't mind that at all. Yeah, I don't mind that at all either.
Really yeah. excellent use of silence.
Yes, very good use of silence, especially in the bomb scenes when you wanted
yeah,
to plug
like
your
so,
ears
yeah.
like
Man,
me.
Yeah, that was amazing. Let's talk about the visuals.
Yeah.
Let's.
So here's one thing, and this is going to sound like a side-handed compliment, like, oh, he's not saying anything. The visuals were very consistent. So, apparently he used zero CGI,
mm-hmm.
not a single computer-generated image, and nothing looks out of place.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. This yeah. Everything looks like it's happening within the movie.
Yeah.
It was amazing. You know what the most remarkable thing is? And I mentioned this to Greg when it happened. I was like, during those sex scenes, those nipples were not CGI, if you can believe that.
They were real.
Now most movies nowadays use stunt nipples. Not this movie. Christopher Nolan dared to dream.
I saw something that there's multiple countries that CGI'd a dress onto her.
I'm not surprised.
Like the caption was like, Nolan's got to be pissed because now there's CGI in his movie. That's like a real thing. They like CGI'd like a dress on her.
That doesn't surprise me at all. There are a lot of countries that have.
It's not surprising.
Modesty laws.
Yeah,
things like that where you can't have nudity in your movies.
I will say, like, I mean, I'm in.
Maybe they're like, oh, Florence Pugh? Nah, we'll cover that up. If it was like someone else, maybe they. Like
Emma Watson.
Yes, please.
Emma Watson.
Bro, I can't see her as anything other than like a young teenager.
We made it an hour without bringing that up.
I will say that I'm one of those people that's just more so in favor of less like very graphic sex scenes in movies. I don't know if I can pick a movie where I'm like, that added a ton to be able to see all of that. Regardless of what your opinion on like wanting to see it or not wanting to see it is, I don't think in any case I'm like, I'm really glad that I got to see like extremely graphic sex scene because that added so much to the movie. And in this case, I think it was even more so in the other direction where I really don't think they're trying to push the point home that he's a ladies man.
Right.
Like, because that's accurate to his
wife.
But
the thing is, we only see him
you can do
with
that.
One lady other than his wife.
Also, this
He mentions that he had an affair with the blonde woman on the base.
Yep.
Huh?
It mentions that he had an affair with, and I thought they were going to be more explicit about that because they were clearly like, she's clearly flirting with him. He's just like not emoting.
Yeah.
And that was another thing that was weird. It was like, oh, he's such a ladies man. Really?
Yeah, that was the mechanical
Joe
he's
over
the
here.
Dark, he's the dark, mysterious type. That's what chicks are into.
The
that.
Blue eyes.
But the thing is,
yeah,
like,
the steely blue eyes.
So I read something. I didn't read the article, but I saw a headline that was something like, "People on the set of Oppenheimer kept getting lost in Cillian Murphy's eyes." And I was like, "Yeah, I can believe that."
Yeah, his eyes are crazy,
but
like, in a good way. But
I feel like like setting him up as this ladies man, and having him be as strange and dry and awkward as he is, they kind of just filled the gaps and assumed, oh, these women must also just be complete robots. And I'm like, I just don't see that being like, I can't
Beep,
think
boop,
back.
Lettuce interface, no, USB
like,
port.
I imagine there had
down,
to be a little
it,
bit of game spit by him, like a little bit of like
some swagger.
Hey baby, I designed the atomic bomb.
And I'd have to assume that this woman who you see naked profusely in this movie had to be more than like she never smiled. She was angry the whole time.
Yeah,
what were they trying to do with her? Like every time he brought her flowers, she'd throw them out, and she's mad that he didn't bring her flowers. And I'm like, why are you pushing this through line
She's a crazy commie.
No,
that's true.
Those are capitalistic flowers.
Yeah, and again, you paid goods for services.
This is unacceptable.
This is part of my, I get one flower. You need to give one flower to the lady down the street, and one flower to the other person.
I think it's a really powerful stance. It's an allegory for communism.
That's like part of my dislike of bioflicks, and not that I dislike them like entirely, but it's just that they typically aren't my favorite. Is because if I'm just like objectively looking at this story, I'd be like, hey, I take that part out. That's stupid. I mean, I would. I would literally be like,
but you can't because that's real life.
I would be like, hey, keep all the communist friends. He's already got a strange background enough. He tried to kill his professor. That's really weird. Take this chick out. Like she adds nothing. Mm-hmm. She's played by a lifeless plank of wood. And
Florence Pugh?
Oh, you're going to tell me that she was charismatic in that movie.
She's probably the best actress he's ever seen.
It has nothing to do.
Yeah. Why don't you just tell us
She might be my favorite actress.
Wait, seriously?
She might be my... You can ask Alyssa how much I like Florence Pugh. I swear to you.
Is that just because she does tapas shots all the time?
She has never done a tapas shot before
this. That's not true.
Before this movie.
I don't think that's true.
I think that's true. Do you remember? Do you recall?
No, I saw on Instagram she was wearing a sheer dress. You could see her nipples through it.
Like in public, like on a press tour?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
And she was I'm proud of it. Like,
I get it.
Whatever.
I can't speak to that. But in other movies, she's clothed.
I guess. I might have seen another movie with Florence Pugh in it, but I couldn't tell you if
Florence
I did.
Pugh.
Yeah, okay.
Liam, what is she like?
Huh?
What is she like when she's not working?
Florence Pugh?
Yeah.
Is a bit.
What's her best qualities?
You lost me.
Yeah, tell us her best qualities.
I don't know, man. I might not like her as a person, but I think she's a great actress, and I can't sit here while you guys.
Good actors and actresses can have bad performances. I wouldn't say it was a bad performance. I just don't think it was like.
I'm positive that they told her, "Hey, act like your mom just got slapped in the face with a fish constantly."
She did it. And so she did.
Yes, but I don't know why. That's why I would poke fun at bioflicks.
Both her and Emily Blunt's character, which is Oppenheimer's wife, whose name I can't remember.
Who's Emily Blunt?
Irrelevant.
Irrelevant. I don't think either of those women smile in the entire movie.
No. I think Emily Blunt might have smiled at the end when she was giving it to the prosecutor.
That was a good scene.
That was a cool scene.
That was really good. Satisfying.
That might win her an Oscar. I'm serious.
No. Okay, listen. Oppenheimer cannot win any Oscars.
It will win
it
all.
It cannot because it does not meet the diversity quota.
Oh, yeah.
Are you being serious?
I'm being dead serious. They changed the way Oscars work. It's like you have to have like 50% people of color or minorities or whatever it is. They're changing the rules for who they nominate for Oscars.
I have heard that they're changing that.
I don't remember what the diversity quota is, but they are changing the rules for the Oscars so that you have to meet diversity quotas. So Oppenheimer would be automatically excluded. I don't know when they're enacting these.
Liam, what do you think about that?
Yeah.
We're not going to get into that.
You know what?
Are we editing this podcast?
You know who was actually in the theater? I don't think you saw him. Jakob was actually sitting right behind
us. Was he really?
I don't know if you heard. Maybe it was like masked by the IMAX rumblings.
Yeah.
But I don't know if you heard him groaning in pain the whole time.
That was him.
So I heard a groaning. I saw him afterwards and he was like, I don't even want to talk to Liam because I'm just like, I just need to write down my feelings.
That's really weird.
And so he did that. He had a quill and an ink like pen with him. That was really weird. He like sat down on parchment.
Yeah, he does use
and
quill
wrote and down. Ink. I'm not carrying a scroll around, so I wrote it down.
Okay.
And I actually sent it to you if you want to read it. Yeah, so.
This is from Jakob. This is my cousin Jakob.
It's a letter from Jakob.
So we got a letter from Jakob, guys.
It's really weird that he keeps sending you guys.
Yeah, I mean, you know what? I think what was happening, he mentioned like the last couple times he sent you a letter, you just haven't responded. So I think he just really likes getting it.
I'm getting really sick of his antics, if I'm being honest with you. He just kind of berates us every week.
That's true. But
it's getting a bit old.
It's important to get. Like we all, you know, despite our differences of opinion, we all thought it was a great movie.
Yeah.
Well, why don't you tell us what Jakob thought?
Okay. All right, here we go. This is a letter from Jakob.
So, Willie, you're trying to tell me that this many white people in the movie is supposed to be acceptable in 2023? Oppenheimer should have been played by a transgender, non-binary, two-spirit, queer-coded BIPOC. All this yada yada about becoming dead in a destroyer world. I'm like, of course you are. You are a white man.
Oh
all time line. 0 out of 10. Go watch Barbie instead, where the men are put in their place.
This guy. Why don't you keep giving this guy airtime? Why don't you keep giving this guy airtime?
It's important to get. You know, it's important to get a variety of opinions.
I guess so, man.
Next guest.
I'm getting sick of it, though. Yeah, we got to get Jakob on this podcast to really flesh out some of his feelings. Watch Barbie with him or something.
You know, this Jakob guy just. Seems like a real jerk.
The more I learn about this Yago guy, the less I care for him.
Maybe his brain was made on opposite day, where he sees good things and interprets them as bad, and sees bad things and interprets them as good.
Yeah, there's something severely wrong with him.
Classic opposite day brain.
Jakob, who hurt you?
He always he always makes a fuss at family reunions and just starts talking about BIPOC. What does that mean? BIPOC?
Black and Indigenous Person of Color.
Oh, okay.
It's, I mean, so it's, you not it's 2023. That? It's time to move on to TriPox.
I know POC.
It's time to move on to TriPox. We've had BIPOCs for too long. We need TriPox. We need QuadPox. It's like we need to do better.
We can't keep giving this guy airtime.
I agree.
Visuals. We're back to visuals. Christian, tell us what you thought about the visuals.
Visuals. Well, I love the grain, like the grittiness of the film. Just the quality. It just felt real.
Now, was that part of it being IMAX, being on like not a digital reel, being it physical, it's physical film projected?
No. Okay.
Or
so,
is that just.
Okay.
Like, so if we'd watched that in a normal theater, would it have had that same grittiness? Mm-hmm.
So when you talk about like film and like recording something digitally, the problem with recording things digitally is that you have less, they call it dynamic range, which means if I took a picture right here, right? You'd probably look fine. The camera or the video camera would expose for you. But if you look at the light above you, that would be what we call nuclear. Like no pun intended. It would just be, the audience can't see the light that's above them all, but you can see the lights in the corner and you see that they just look white. You can't tell any definition in the lamp over there and the lamp up there. Whereas we look at it with our eyes and we can see, oh, it's made out of some kind of fiber, whatever, plastic.
It's called cloth.
You can see the grain in it. Okay, I don't know, whatever.
Chinese spy balloon.
This is the remains of the Chinese spy balloon.
The point that I'm making is that with less dynamic range, you see less texture. Like the light blows things out. Yeah. And when you shoot on film, you have an extremely wide dynamic range. Like you can see the texture in the sky and how the light's reflecting off of clouds just as easy as you can see the person's face in front of you and the dimples, you know, and the acne scars that they have on their face. It's going to capture all of that. It's a lot more work. And digital cameras are getting great, especially at film, like in movie quality.
Like the really high end.
That difference is small. Like at the scale of watching it at an IMAX where the screen is that big, we probably were seeing a lot of benefits of seeing something that was recorded on actual film, but it's typically like for the case like the we're doing or videos you're watching on your phone or your TV, like 90% of the videos on planet are, you'd never really be able to tell. The emphasis that he had on recording in film definitely improved the viewing experience big time, because I think what you're talking about, like the depth of the shots, like how dark, and that's stuff that, like, even though I understand that stuff more, just being that's my practice, like, I still don't, like, anybody could have put the effort in and done that.
Yeah.
It's not like, I wouldn't say that that's creative chops. Okay. Like, so it's just him recording on a more expensive thing and putting more time and energy into it, which is good. I think it's always
something a lot of people don't do anymore.
Yes. And it is also funny, is the last thing I'll mention. Like, it's funny that like, you know, going through the 2000s where, if you were making a movie, you'd probably market yourself as being a movie that had more CGI stuff so people would come see. And they're like, oh, it's so cool, the computer. Yeah, it's amazing. And then now a big marketing point is there is no CGI. Yeah. And we're like, oh,
do you guys remember? I think it was like the first ever all green screen movie, Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow.
Yeah.
It looks weird. Everything's foggy. Right. It's not a bad movie. Like, it's a good movie, but it.
Very artsy.
Yeah, very artsy.
Angelina Jolie.
Yeah.
She has an eye patch. She's still hot. Probably should have played Belle.
Bruh. You're doing this to yourself.
She's got black hair. Okay, you can dye your hair, but like still.
Oh my gosh.
Are you aware of our Emma Watson?
Bruh. Oh yeah. I think I listened to a little bit of the last episode.
What's your thoughts on Emma Watson?
Yeah.
No, that's not the question. Okay, the question.
Should have married Harry Potter. Very disappointed.
Yeah, I agree with that.
True. True. I completely agree.
The question point, yeah. is this. Do you think that she is a good Belle?
I have not seen that movie. So I can't really say.
Like, picture Emma Watson in your head.
I can't beat the cartoon. That's
it's true.
That's so good.
That's
she's
true.
She's fine.
Here is something that stuck out to me about the cinematography. And it's like the exact opposite of what's been really frustrating me about the Disney live action remakes.
Yeah.
Is, you know, there were a lot of shots at night, but I could still see everything I was supposed to see.
Yes. Great point.
Whereas in all the Disney ones, it's like I'm looking through blackout glasses, like eclipse glasses. Yeah. I'm like, you were just incompetent at your job. You just don't, you can't do lighting.
Right. Yeah. That's a great point.
That's
so
another thing.
For
that,
Snow White?
Hey, we talked on that last week. Christian. Yeah. Oh, it's going to be a...
You mean Nieve Latina?
Bruh.
You mean Snow...
And the seven... No, and the seven... And the seven Renfest runaways.
Seven people. Seven guys.
Seven individuals.
We'll just call them guys.
Portland.
Seven guys.
Portland.
Just a couple of guys. Yeah.
And the seven people who wandered in from Portlandia.
The Portlandians, yeah. Yeah.
No, I don't want to go off on a tangent, but they're like, "Oh yeah, she's gonna be about discovering herself, but she's not gonna be rescued by a man." I'm like,
"I saw that."
So you're changing the entire plot of the damn movie? Why even bother remaking it?
Make a new movie. Make another movie.
Make a new princess.
Yeah,
just a whole new name.
Yeah, make a new princess because they can't.
They
come
did.
Up with,
she's
can't
called Rey, and everyone hates her.
They can't come up with original ideas. That's the problem.
Or nude princess.
Jeez.
Okay,
Greg.
Come on, Greg.
We're gonna cut that out.
Honestly, yeah, we're honestly probably not too far away where Disney will try to get away with that and be like, it's our first all nude. You know, it's about a nudist
wrong.
Family.
When it happens. But it's a guy and who transitioned to a girl, so it doesn't really count.
And they're 400 pounds.
Anyway, all right, so give us your last
Disney. If you use that idea, you have to pay us.
Wrap up thoughts here of Oppenheimer. We watched it in theaters. We got a chance to talk about it.
Yeah.
You know what is your final conclusion there, Nathaniel?
I would say 100% go watch it in IMAX or like the Dolby surrounds, like whatever theater you can get that has the best sound.
Yeah.
That's where you're going to get the most out of it, and be ready to have your seat shaken. Mm-hmm. Your seat shaken. Mm-hmm. It's really good. And it is a 3-hour movie, so it's a long time, so you're going to be there for 4 hours because of commercials. Don't drink a lot before the movie because you can't miss anything or you're going to be lost.
Yeah, it is definitely not the kind of movie that you can skip out.
But it's a movie that rewards careful watching.
Yeah.
I think it makes it rewatchable.
I agree.
I think it is rewatchable because it's so dense. It's well-paced. It's very dense. It's kind of a bleak movie. So it's not a very happy movie, but it is a very well-done, cerebral. I mean, it is peak Nolan. Mm-hmm. It's if you go to movies for the emotional beats, you're not going to get a lot out of this movie.
Yeah.
But if you go to watch excellent cinematography, snappy, let me pull back on snappy.
It's not snappy.
Well, constructed and paced dialogue and one of the most tremendous scenes in cinema, that Trinity Test moment, you're going to love this movie.
Yeah.
If you go expecting a happy clappy, if you go in expecting something you might get out of the Barbie movie, other than brain damage. I don't think you'll enjoy Oppenheimer. And that's okay. It's okay to not want to see this movie. It is a biopic, which again, even to Greg's point, I'm not a huge biopic guy. So like, I don't know how many times I would want to rewatch this movie. I don't know how much it appeals to me as like something like, yeah, I want to go see it. But I think it's definitely worth watching once, especially in theaters.
Yeah.
I would like, before I get into my final thoughts, I'd like to pose a hypothetical to you guys.
All right, let's hear it.
Has there ever been a better cast in a movie?
I can't answer that question because everyone looks the same to me.
I want you to think about it just for a second.
Yes, because you know who it didn't have? It didn't have Gene Wilder. It didn't have Danny Kaye.
Okay.
Yes.
It didn't have Denzel Washington.
Would Leonardo been better than
Oppenheimer? I mean, I would like for you to
think of one. Have you seen the cast for Much Ado About Nothing?
No. I've never even heard of that movie.
It's a Shakespeare play.
I've never heard of Shakespeare.
Movie. It had Kenneth Branagh.
Hardly know.
It had Denzel Washington. It had Keanu Reeves.
Kenneth Branagh was in Oppenheimer, isn't he?
Yes, he was.
Okay, there you go.
But yeah, that's a star-studded cast, and you get to see everyone's butt. It's great.
Nice.
I would say Ocean's 12.
It's really good.
That's a great cast for not a very good movie.
It's not a very good movie.
That's comparable.
The cast is like, all the Ocean's.
Here's
movies.
My frame. Obviously, you get big names. Mm-hmm. Robert Downey Jr. is going to win best if it's eligible. I don't know. That's interesting.
Could be.
Robert Downey Jr. is going to win best supporting actor. Cillian Murphy will win best actor. Emily Blunt is going to get nominated for best supporting actress. They got three best actor winners showing up for like 5 minutes.
It should Casey certainly Affleck, win.
Gary Oldman, Rami Malek. They're like the
Rami
guys.
Malek, I remember. Who's Gary Oldman?
Gary Oldman was the president.
Truman.
Oh, yeah.
Which is wild. He's probably the most acclaimed out of all those guys.
Yeah. Yeah. So, like, Oldman's that's what I'm saying. These are like guys like 9 and 10 on the Rolodex in this movie.
Yeah.
And they're best actor winners. And that's without even mentioning my favorite actor of all time, Mr. Matt Damon.
Love it.
That's like Mr. Matt Damon is not going to get nominated probably, although he's phenomenal. But like that's what we're talking about with this movie and this cast, man. It is unbelievable.
I don't know.
Matt Damon is the fifth guy on the title card.
And the thing about Matt Damon is his character is so crucial to kind of bringing a more human element into the story.
For sure.
But because of that, he's so understated relative to the rest of the larger-than-life characters that I think people will be like, oh, yeah, Matt Damon was also there. But if you take him out of the movie, I think so much of it just kind of falls apart.
Yeah, I think
him.
That's a great point. He helps, like, level it down to, like, us normal people that
are normal
fission scientists.
I'm not sure if I love that, though. I thought it was good. Well, this is my – I'll break down the point. Like, so have you guys seen the movie 1917?
Yes.
Nope.
Yeah.
Okay.
Great.
Very good movie.
Better.
Very good movie. There's a part at the end when he finally gets the person he's trying to talk to, and it's Benedict Cumberbatch. And for me, I was just kind of like, why did that need to be Benedict Cumberbatch? He was there for 15 like seconds, and. Like, when you just shove a really well-known actor into roles like that, like, there's a reason they don't typically play no-name characters in movies. Because all you're thinking in that is, oh, it's Benedict Cumberbatch. He's the guy. And he's there for 10 minutes and he leaves. You're not thinking about the role he's playing at all. Casey Affleck played a role in this movie. And I was like, oh, it's Casey Affleck.
Who was he?
Exactly.
No.
He was Casey Affleck.
I disagree. I don't have a face.
Fully.
See, for me, that doesn't bother me because for the most part, I don't recognize anyone.
Well,
on the screen.
I will say for like Gary Oldman, who you could barely recognize him, like not only his voice but his appearance, like he generally looked like a different person. I had to squint and be like, oh, that's Gary Oldman. I mean, I would even say Robert Downey did a pretty good job at getting into his character. But again,
it was weird when they were like, Congressman, Mr. Strauss, what do you have to say to these allegations? And he said, well, I am Iron Man.
Yeah.
It felt like a weird defense.
But I guess what I would say is when you have everybody playing a role, you're just more interested in seeing the actor come up on screen. Like Rami Malek, it was just kind of confusing that that needed to be played by some no-name actor. Like,
why?
Because it would have drawn me more into the story. Because now I'm like, oh, this is clearly a movie with famous actors at every single corner.
Yeah, that doesn't bother me.
That's a
you
bad
problem.
Thing
I think it's
for
a you,
you
problem.
No, not for main characters, but when they play a random person walking by, then you know that like we've been watching Fast and Furious movies, God bless our hearts. And it was like 12 movies in, they started doing this theme where they just had a random cameo from a person that's not an actor just show up and play a role.
And they're always the worst part. Like, oh my gosh, who was that? It was Cardi B.
Cardi B was a random SWAT person. Gosh. Like took her SWAT helmet off and she's like, "Hey, I'm so and again, these movies are memes. I'm not
they call me
it,
Cardi. Body.
I'm not saying it's on the same level. But the problem with that is you watch that and you're going, oh, the only reason this person here is to
stunt
be
casting.
Cardi B.
And that's totally different.
I actually disagree with you on this,
okay,
Greg.
It's very different. And I'm not saying it's on the same level at all, but I am saying there are few characters in a movie that, in my opinion, don't need to be played by people that you can just recognize right away. It takes a little bit away from me. It doesn't ruin the movie by any means.
You're taking food out of those millionaires' mouths, Greg, by saying you can't have this job.
It very much seems like we watch those people acting in those points. Whereas I would say Cillian Murphy, Robert Downey, Emily Blunt very much got into their roles, and they do because they're main characters and you follow them through the whole movie and they convince you that they're not themselves. When you just see somebody flash up and flash away, you're like, hey, remember that one part that famous actor was in for that one scene?
I didn't get that from
Damon. It wasn't just famous, though. It was like excellent actors. It wasn't just a big name. It's like, oh, these are like really, really great actors, and I kind of didn't see them as Casey Affleck because he's such a good actor that like quickly it didn't take a whole lot of
what character was he? You keep saying Casey Affleck. I have no idea who you're talking about.
He was the guy who was like secretly he was secretly the general interrogating.
That was, he was the general that was like that was trying to get information out of Oppenheimer. And they were
The attorney guy?
No, he was the attorney. Like he was the guy that the attorney brought in. That was like that was a general. Like he wore a fancy uniform.
Remember, it was like kind of an interrogation scene, but it wasn't. But like it was.
Yeah, he was just like, oh, like what was the person that leaked? And he's like, oh, well, it might have been a friend of somebody.
Yeah, remember? When Oppenheimer lied.
I didn't get taken out of that, but I didn't also you didn't know. And I'm not. But again, so that's a you problem.
No, okay. And I'm not saying that all of a sudden I threw my hands up and the movie was useless. I'm just saying I think it's a little bit better when everybody.
So what you're saying is anytime you have a small bit actor, you have to get someone that nobody knows so that they don't get pulled out of the movie.
I think there are times that that's more effective.
But isn't there also like small bit actors where you're like, it's a dude from The Boys. Like it's kind of like the same fit. Like it's like a little different.
And
but like,
The Boys. Great.
Like when we saw Josh Peck or whatever.
Yeah.
Like that to me was useless.
I agree with that because he's so known for a Nickelodeon show. Like it's
he doesn't have a serious face.
Again, so this is the Shia LaBeouf problem. Yeah, this is the Shia LaBeouf problem where if you grew up watching Even Stevens, you can't take Shia LaBeouf seriously in anything he is.
I disagree.
That's just something you have to get over, right? I mean, but that's true of anyone who gets typecast. I mean, right, Robert Downey Jr. Even Robert Downey Jr. is like, oh, he's not. What are most people going to recognize him from?
Tropic Thunder, man.
Tropic Thunder.
Would they recognize him? I'm the guy. I'm a dude playing a dude dressed up as another dude. That movie is so good.
It's great.
It's gold.
It's great. It's great.
And it could not be made today.
No. Gosh, no.
But anyway.
But the point is, like, a lot of people have that one breakout role, and it's very hard if you know them from that role, it's very hard to see them as anything but that character unless they just have a phenomenal range. Or like Colin Farrell in The Batman, where he just has so much makeup he's unrecognizable.
Yeah.
Right.
In moments
that's
like
always going to be a problem. But it's like you should be. So it comes down to what are the intentions behind casting that person? Are you casting that person because they A, look like the – because we have pictures of all these people. We know what they look like. So you try to get someone who looks similar to that, which if you look at Cillian Murphy and a picture of Oppenheimer, it's like it's pretty close.
Oh, yeah.
Pretty close. You know, they didn't just cast Cillian Murphy because he's a great actor, but also because he kind of looks like the guy he's supposed to be playing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't unhappy with any of the acting performances, and so it stuck out less that they got all these big names to play small roles. But I think what Nathaniel said is exactly the problem usually, because usually you watch a character like that and you're like, oh, you were so small that I know you didn't have to be in the movie. So I know that you're only in the movie because
right, but a lot of them are like, oh, Christopher Nolan's like, hey, I want you to do this part because I'm envisioning you in this role, and they're like, oh yeah, Christopher Nolan, of course I'm going to say yes,
even though it's not the biggest role in the world.
Okay, so you know who does that and does a good job of that? Wes Anderson.
Yeah,
Wes Anderson has a bunch of big name actors that will just come into his movies and play really small parts.
That's true,
and it never bothers you.
I think Adam Sandler's the best at it.
I take.
What has he done recently? Other than Uncut Gems,
Hubie Halloween.
There was the recent one.
Hustle.
The
Hustle.
Murder Mystery.
Murder Mystery 2.
There's another one, Outlaws. Or, yeah.
Insert
is he,
dumb
is he doing
Netflix
like serious
movie.
Stuff now, or is he still doing trying to do comedy?
They're all serious.
Now, the Outlaws is an Adam Sandler.
Okay, Mr. Deeds.
Is Adam Sandler.
Banger.
Isn't it the guy
50 First Dates?
Also Outlaws is Adam Sandler produced.
Oh, Adam Sandler produced. One of his, okay. Yeah. Got you.
Let it up.
I haven't forgiven him for trying to do Pixels, but. Yeah, I mean, we're getting off topic.
Okay,
but
my final thought is it's one of the best movies of my lifetime. It might go down as my favorite movie theater viewing experience ever.
Bruh. We need to ask him this again in 10 years.
And
you can ask him in 10 days.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, I was just enamored.
We're going to come back from, we're going to go watch Barbie. We're going to go back to like, it's one of the best movies I've ever seen.
I wouldn't change a single thing.
Bruh.
Except for maybe the scene where Florence Pugh is riding Cillian Murphy in the middle of the hearing.
The only thing he would change is to put a CGI
hearing.
Dress over her.
You guys remember that? We talked about that.
Yeah.
That was weird, right?
I lumped
that was
in
when
all
they did
the sex
whole
scenes and
Sanskrit
I
thing.
Included that,
that was weird.
In the part of being like they went a little
totally
over
the top. I can't disagree with
totally
that.
That was
strange.
That was like.
But yeah, Christopher Nolan, best director. Lock it up. That's going to be his first one. Wow, that's going to be his first one. But it should be if he fits diversity protocol.
Yeah, I will say he seems to be the only one of the only directors in Hollywood that actually has like creative vision and is willing to take risks.
Yeah,
sometimes you get Tenet and sometimes you get Inception.
And even Tenet, his worst movie is better than a lot of movies just because it's creative and unique.
I wish we had time to talk about his brother.
Oh my gosh,
nepotism.
Yeah.
His brother is
no. Well, he's got another brother. He's got another
Oppenheimer.
Brother.
No, Nolan.
Nolan has a middle brother.
Yeah, Nolan's brother, the hitman named Oppenheimer.
Yeah.
Is he named Oppenheimer?
Yeah, he
No, that's his nickname. His hitman name is Oppenheimer. Yeah, yeah. You can't make that stuff up, man.
Yeah, that's awesome. That stuff is wild.
Poetic.
All right, Christian, what are your ending thoughts here? Give us your last thoughts.
I think everybody did such a great job wrapping it up that I had to just say, like, do we really believe that Oppenheimer's from New Mexico? I mean, have you ever met anyone from New Mexico that's as productive as that guy?
No. He was from New York.
I've never met anyone.
And he just had a ranch in New Mexico.
Ah, I thought he was from there.
No, he's from New York.
That's why no one else greats come from New Mexico, because the fallout.
Yep. They're all. Yeah. If you go to New Mexico, you'll notice everyone has like three arms and seven eyes. It's very awkward.
Area 51.
They're lovely people.
That.
They're lovely people.
They mean well.
Yeah.
It's very hard for them to go clothes shopping.
man.
Dude. I would, you know, and then do we say that Oppenheimer, like, do we give him the credibility? I mean, he was really just a lab director and didn't actually invent the bomb.
Well, I mean, he was managing it. He was a scientist. I mean, they did kind of mention, like, hey, you're not even doing the science stuff anymore. But, I mean, he was a scientific genius. He was getting everyone's ideas and funneling them into productive manners, which is not an insignificant thing, especially when it comes to the scientists of this type tend to get very one track, like the guy with the H-bomb.
Yeah.
He was like, oh, you guys are working on an H-bomb. I want to work on an H-bomb. He's like, no. We need to be – but you need a fission component for that anyways. So focus on this one project. So his role as a project manager was very important to the actual completion of the bomb. And I think he had the scientific knowledge to understand everything that was happening, which if you're a project manager and you don't understand what's going on, that could lead to disaster. So
as a project manager, I hope they make a movie off of me one day. And Jim Carpenter.
Maybe they will.
You're working on the Cube bomb.
Are you doing significant things like the atom bomb?
The Brooklyn Project?
No, maybe, you know, I'm still young.
I
got time.
The Huntersville Project.
The Huntersville Project. Beach Lagoon. Yeah.
Yeah.
Look forward to it.
Christian
is
to
death, destroyer of.
Christian destroyer is sand, of Charlotte. Maker of beaches.
Sand.
Destroyer sand. Sand.
Creator of beaches.
Last thoughts. last thoughts on Oppenheimer. Excellent movie. Probably best movie of the year.
Oh, definitely the best movie I've seen this year that came out this year.
Mm-hmm. I would say it's 100% like not even like worth seeing in theaters. Like you need to see it in theaters. Go watch it in theaters before you watch it at home. Watch it again at home. You'll need to. There's a lot to digest there. Yep. Definitely some pacing things that I would have changed as far as like the time frame stuff. Still think it should have ended with a bomb. Some unnecessary stuff with the sex scenes and some dialogue that kind of drug on, and not a whole lot of emotional attachment to really anybody in the movie. I did not feel emotionally attached, but that's not the point. Incredible movie. Great viewing experience in the theaters. It's even better if you just have Nathaniel make you a steak beforehand. It actually makes it makes
that did happen.
Steak, shrimp, mashed potatoes, fresh bread.
We feasted, and then we smoked cigars and drank delicious whiskey.
Yeah,
and then we saw.
Yeah, and then we saw.
It was a good day.
It was good.
Yeah,
day.
You did miss
Sorry, Christian.
It was kind of.
Liam could have invited you to dinner, but he didn't.
Yeah. I could.
He could have.
I mean,
we had
nice
plenty.
Enough.
We had tons of food.
So much leftover steak, Christian.
But overall, incredible movie. Not my favorite Nolan movie by a long shot. Not a huge fan of biopics, but I thought it was amazing. One of the best directors of our time. Definitely one of the few directors that are still making creative content. So go watch it for sure.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Like, even though Greg and I are both like, yeah, we don't really like biopics.
Yeah.
Thought this was an excellent movie worth watching. So
absolutely.
That's about as strong praise as we can give it.
So our next show will be
I haven't picked
16th.
I've picked.
And yeah, I was about to ask you what are we watching next?
Well, you guys complained that you didn't want to do Lady and the Tramp. I was thinking maybe 101 Dalmatians, but I want to watch a good one. So we'll do Aladdin.
Yes.
Hey. We'll do Aladdin because I want to do 101 Dalmatians, but I know it was made before the 1990s, so Liam Otter already ate it.
Yeah. I have checked out. Thank you.
So even though it has arguably one of the best songs in any Disney movie ever.
Lady and Tramp?
No. Lady and the Tramp's going to be trash. Aladdin. Both of the No. 101 Dalmatians.
I wasn't listening when you were talking. Wait, which song?
Cruella de Vil.
Good. Really good.
Cruella
good
de
villain.
Vil.
Good villain song. Unlike stupid Lion King villain song.
Beep, rap,
whatever that one was.
Well, certainly not the live action one. But anyways,
that's our show. Yep. Hit us up, Twitter. We got a audio-only podcast on Spotify. And email us, dearlydebated@gmail.com. And check out The Kitchen Chemist, Season 2, coming in September.
Follow Christian on Instagram. Christian, what's your Instagram? Christian, what's your address?
What's your social security number?
You could find me.
Give us your last name.
When's the beach project going to be finished?
Yeah, what's
the is your last name Liam's friend?
My last Liam's friend? Name is Lanius. They didn't
That's
want to.
Close.
I didn't want to disclose that early on because it's German and that could, you know,
have a conflict of interest.
Conflict of interest. Did you leak
our podcast information out to your German friends? You dog.
He does a big Heisenberg fan. I was really rooting for him in the movie.
Hot take.
That is a hot take.
Well, people, until next time.
I thought I might have had him, but
until next time, we have been the Dearly Debated.